Time to take another look at the wonderful world of wildlife. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Glad to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Jamie Nack and David Drake are back. It's always fun to have them come by. Jamie's UW Extension Wildlife Outreach Specialist in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison. David, a professor in that same department and with UW Extension. He's a wildlife specialist. They have great information about a couple of DNR programs, and we'll share some wildlife watching opportunities with you. I hope you'll join in. What types of wildlife do you like to watch? Or maybe you've got an experience to share. I hope you'll join in. 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org. Or go ahead and post a question. And if you got a nice wildlife photo, we had some great ones last time they were on. Post that up on our Facebook page. Our Facebook page title is The Larry Mueller Show. Jamie Nack, welcome back.
Hey, it's great to be here. Thanks for having us.
And David Drake, same to you.
Thank you, Larry.
Well, we've got lots to talk about today. Tell us about Operation Deer Watch first.
Yeah, so this has been an ongoing effort. In the past, the Department of Natural Resource biologists would do the record keeping or the surveys. So while they were out in the field during their normal daily activities in August and September, they would take note of any deer that they saw during daylight hours and record whether that was a doe with a fawn or a doe alone or a buck. And so on. And that information was used to help calculate fawn-to-doe ratios for the north and the southern part of the state that went into estimating deer population levels and eventually in developing deer season framework, harvest quotas, and permit recommendations. And in the more frequent years, the past few years, they've really opened that up to citizens to get involved as well. More data is always better.
Sure.
And it gives the public some buy-in. So they get a chance to observe deer, record that data, knowing that that data is going to get used by the department. So right now is the time. From August 1st till September 30th, citizens can participate in Operation Deer Watch. And if you go to the Department of Natural Resources webpage and type in Operation Deer Watch, you'll get to that page. And you can print out a form, which I did this morning. And it is very, very easy to keep this along, put a clipboard in your car, and
sure.
You can record things. So it asks for the date, the zone, whether you were in a farmland or forest zone, and there's a nice map included on the tally sheet, the county of locations, and then you basically keep a record then, how many bucks, how many does without fawns, how many fawns without does, and then how many combinations of does with a fawn or does with twins, etc. So this morning driving in with my two daughters in the car, we had a doe and a fawn cross the road. And so,
oh, cool.
We have recorded that. So we've got one doe fawn pair that was noted today. So one thing we want to be careful of, we have been seeing her frequently. We don't want to record that every single day. But
yeah.
So if you know you're seeing the same deer, you don't need to continue to record it. But again, that's statewide. So if you travel up north this weekend, you can continue to collect data. You just need to report it for that particular county and zone.
And then, you report it online or just
yes.
Keep the paper with you, but then later report it online?
Exactly. So you have two options. You can take that data and enter it online, which would really help because they don't have to re-enter it. But you can also take your paper form and mail it to the Department of Natural Resources.
Okay.
And that address is provided, again, on the DNR's website under Operation Deer Watch. So, again,
how are those data used then?
Yep. So that information, they're really looking at reproductive success. So what kind of reproduction did we see? So did does tend to have more than one offspring? It gives us an indication of the past winter severity and habitat conditions across the state as well. That information now with the county deer advisory councils is information that'll be provided to those county councils as additional data as they set their make their decisions for the county on whether they're going to increase, decrease, or remain stable for that county's deer population. So more metrics
cool.
to get looked at. So
yeah.
I encourage everybody to do it. It's just fun. It was fun to involve the kids in it this morning. So we'll get them on the computer and enter some data for us too. So
there you go. Well, now we another program. You talked about it last time a bit, Snapshot Wisconsin. Refresh my memory on what that program's all about.
So that's a DNR, Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources-led program, and it's got many multiple partners. It's funded partly by NASA and some other groups, but the University of Wisconsin-Madison and the University of Wisconsin Extension are active partners in that. And essentially, ultimately, the DNR wants to get out upwards of 6,000 trail cameras or game cameras across the state of Wisconsin.
And, that's cool.
Yeah, and so they're trying to get on public land, private land, urban, rural, really get a good sense about what kind of wildlife are out there across the state. And so they'll buy the cameras, and there's a bit of a training program, but they've got staff at the DNR who will go out and help you set up the camera and get you started. Cameras are pre-programmed, so you can't really mess with the programming because that can alter the types of photographs that are taken and kind of bias the data and things of that nature. But, I mean, essentially, really the biggest thing is they are looking for access and private land and permission to set the camera in your property. And then there's some responsibility you as the landowner would have that you'd check the camera periodically and make sure the batteries are working and maybe switch out the SD card and things like that. And then photographs are downloaded to a large, what's called Zooniverse, and it's a large citizen science portal through the Adler Planetarium in Chicago. And I think last year, Snapshot Wisconsin is entering into its second season.
Yeah.
Currently, they have cameras in two counties. I think it's Iowa and Sawyer County.
Correct. Yep.
Right now. And then they've got cameras actually also at the elk reintroduction site in the Central Forest region of Wisconsin. But they're going to roll these cameras out over the next two or three years across the state. But I think last year they had, I want to say it was 85,000 people from around the world went to the Zooniverse site and actually looked at the photographs that were downloaded out of all these cameras. And so 85,000 people essentially said, you know, yes, that's a mink, yes, that's a deer, yes, that's a turkey, whatever the case is. And so similar to Operation Deer Watch, I think as a scientific community and you know, some of these management agencies, we're getting much better at involving the public in citizen science and asking the public to help collect data for us.
And is there some research component to this? I mean, how are the photos used?
Yeah, so there is, I mean, the basic thing is trying to just get an index or a sense about what wildlife are out there, where are they in the state, things like that. It's difficult to get a population estimate because you have to be able to mark individuals and you don't necessarily know whether you're seeing the same deer on the camera or not, or if it's 10 separate deer. So, but it does give you a sense about what animals are there. And there's different types of research can go on in terms of occupancy modeling, for example. And so you could say, well, we see an animal. We see, you know, for example, a fisher in this block here. So based on that and the type of habitat, we could model and say, well, we'd expect fishers to be in these other blocks as well. And so there's a lot of different types of research going on depending on what the specific question is being asked. But the biggest thing is just getting an index, a sense about what wildlife are out there across the state and where they are and things like that. And I think, as Jamie said, that, you know, citizen science is very, very efficient because you've got all these eyes of the public out there helping you collect data. But the other thing I think is really valuable, as Jamie correctly pointed out, is that it does kind of hook the public. It's buy-in. And once the public starts getting bought in, then you start building a constituent base. And then they really start getting interested in what you're doing. And then that program is able to kind of take off and sustain itself. And so there's a tremendous amount of benefit from citizen science and some of these programs like Snapshot Wisconsin or Operation Deer Watch.
Chris and the Dells called in to remind people to be careful driving right now. The deer are out eating in the farm fields and they're close to the roads. And that's, Chris, that's good advice, isn't it?
Yeah, this is definitely the time of the year and coming into the fall season. So we've got more fawns that are mobile now and moving on their own. And this is their first time crossing roads. And the one this morning, too, if we hadn't stopped, I mean, it eventually crossed right behind us in the car. But so this is their first time navigating traffic. And then as we get into the pre-rut and the rut, we're going to have a lot of deer movement, too. So just a reminder to be looking on the sides of the roads. And certainly if you see a deer, stop, because even though that one made it across, there's very likely another one behind it.
Yep. So slow down, take it easy.
Usually the first 2 to 3 weeks of November are the highest deer vehicle collision statistics, because that's during the rut and that's when most of the deer are moving. So but from now through at least probably mid-November, you want to be very, very careful.
Talking with Jamie Nack and David Drake today from the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison. You can join in, too. We'd love to hear from you at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Maybe you've participated in a wildlife count. Maybe you're seeing some fun things in terms of wildlife in your area. Love to hear from you. So give a call or shoot us a photo or a question on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. We are getting close to migration for many species as well. We probably talk about that. We're going to see a lot more geese, for example, probably in pretty short order.
Yep, the geese, waterfowl. This is kind of a time when animals are starting to stock up, and they have been doing so through the summer, but they're trying to put some fat on right now. So if you're going into hibernation, you need a pretty good fat store to make it through the winter. And if you're migrating south, you need a lot of energy stored up in your body so you can start flying and moving south. And so we are starting to get some of the early migratory birds, some of the warblers that go further north up into Canada for breeding season during the summer, that they're starting to show up in they should start showing up here pretty soon in the northern counties of Wisconsin as they make their way south. And then from now through probably mid-November, end of November, it'll just be this long, drawn-out migration, and it really goes in stages. So you get some of the early migratory birds, like some of the warblers, blackpoll warblers, and things like that, and then you'll get into some waterfowl, and some of the last migrating birds in our state are sandhill cranes, and so you'll see them in November still sometimes. And I don't know, I've got Jamie, probably you have too, I've gotten a couple of calls occasionally about somebody might have a hummingbird at their feeder if we still have a mild December, which is, that's pretty dang late for a hummingbird, but...
Yeah, it happens. Yeah.
But then the other species that are migrating are, we've got 7 bat species in Wisconsin. 3 of those migrate out of our state. The other 4 are resident species and will hibernate through the winter. But the 3 that migrate, that they'll start migrating here, as early as maybe mid-August or something like that, and then move out of the state, through September.
I've got a sort of on the other end of it in a way. I've got a little birdhouse on a tree that's right next to my porch. And we've got a couple of house finches that are raising a family there right now. I get all kinds of grief every time I walk out.
Are they house wrens?
Wrens.
That's what I was
house
thinking.
Wrens, not
that's
house,
been,
wrens. House wrens.
We recently moved, and we have adopted some of the bird feeder or bird houses that have been left, and we've watched. These weren't in a bird house, but in a shrub. But we've fledged brown thrashers and bluebirds and a couple of robins. And there's a feisty family of wrens. And I think they are very quickly becoming one of my favorite birds.
They have such an
attitude.
They do. And they always are chipping at you.
Yeah, they
for
are.
For sure. But
we like to sit out on the porch in the evening, and maybe have a drink or something. Yeah. Or sometimes eat out there. Yeah. And, boy, they're... But they don't dive bomb or anything, but they certainly let you know they're not happy.
You're in their area.
But at least you don't have to avoid the swallows. They're the dive bombers.
They're the dive bombers.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Oh. Well, we've noticed a lot, too. The hummingbirds have been very, very active at the feeder and fighting over that nectar, so I'm filling it pretty mm-hmm. frequently. And they're fairly early. They're early September, mid-September for migration as well. So they're working hard to feed the young and...
Yeah. One of my friends posted a photo on his Facebook page. He's in on a lake in kind of north central Wisconsin, and there had to be 15 hummingbirds around his feeder.
Yeah.
So it was
That's
amazing things. Yeah. Jerry in Oconto Falls, thanks for calling.
Hello, everybody. Great show today.
Thank you.
I live up in Oconto County, and I also drive truck locally on the back roads, and I've been seeing a lot more does this year with twins than with singles. I think it's because we had such a mild winter up here last year, but the deer population is way up. I can go out even close to my house every night, and I can view anywhere from 20 to 80 deer within 3-4 miles of my house.
Wow.
So I think we got a bumper crop this year.
Well, that's very good, and that's good to hear, and I think you're correct. We've had some rebuilding years here with the deer herd, especially in the north, lightened up on some of the antlerless harvest permits that were available. So we would expect to see some healthy reproduction with a more mild winter this past year. So that's good, and I'd encourage you to take that clipboard and the data sheet and start recording some of those for Oconto County.
Yeah, about 3-4 weeks ago, I was seeing quite a few bucks together, two or three in groups, but now I don't know if they're separated or if they're just kind of hiding out or whatever, but I haven't been seeing groups of bucks lately.
Yeah.
Yeah, it can be challenging to see deer at this time of year. The vegetation is just about at its height, you know, its peak of density and height. It can be really hard to see them. Unless they're needing relief from the biting flies and insects, they'll come out to the open areas and forage. So at dawn and dusk is still a pretty good time to see those deer. But and bucks, too, their antlers are about as big as they're going to get right now. And in another month or so, they'll start shedding that velvet. So.
Yep. Yeah, it's fun to watch. Thanks a lot for calling, Jerry. Appreciate your call. I just, as an aside, we did a daughter and I were on about a 3-mile hike, and we saw a flock of hen turkeys.
Oh, yeah.
And then in another spot, we saw a flock of male, of tom turkeys.
Yep. Yep.
Yeah,
so they're kind of all separated out right now.
Yeah, it was interesting. We had a mixed flock this morning
in
a field. Yeah, there were, they were, you know, all in the field together, but sort of separated in the field. But yeah, there was 4 nice toms and another subset of 4 or 5 hens in the group. So,
Any poults in either group you saw, Larry? Or
no,
Jamie? I didn't
they
see
were
poults
adults.
In that group, but I have seen poults this summer. So.
Jamie Nack and David Drake, our guests today. I'm Larry Mueller. Jill Nadeau, our on-air producer. I hope you'll join in with your questions, comments, or maybe experiences to share at 1-800-642-1234 here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up at 2 o'clock today, a biology professor who has spent years studying the brain joins Kathleen Dunn to talk about what is and what is not normal memory loss. How's your memory today for wildlife? Jamie Nack and David Drake from the UW Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology and UW Extension are with us today. Join in at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or, again, post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Let's go to Bob in Eau Claire next. Bob, hi. Thanks for calling.
Good morning, guys.
Good morning.
You were just talking about hummingbird feeders, and we have got nowhere near the numbers that other people are reporting, but we do have a few. But our problem is that we have got swarms of bees around the hummingbird feeders constantly. And in fact, we have been forced to move the feeders away from the house, far away from the house, just so we don't have the bees swarming at us when we try to sit out on our deck. And, you know, and we've got a rain garden with all kinds of, like, Joe Pye weed and a variety of different plants for pollinators. We really do want the bees to have something to eat, but they're almost to the point where they're being a nuisance. How do we deal with that?
Well, Bob, let me ask you, what are you doing for your nectar solution?
It's a 4-to-1.
Okay, so you are just using the household sugar water mixture.
Exactly.
I was just curious if there was anything there. But, well, it's good that you're not trying to, you know, necessarily kill the bees. We value, you know. You know, their contributions as well. Sometimes you may hear that people will talk about putting some Vaseline around the rim of that hummingbird feeder, and that's something I want to make sure to get out, that's something we wouldn't recommend, because that Vaseline can get on the feathers of those hummingbirds, and they're so small, it can really just kind of get in the way of their flight behavior, you know, just everything from them being able to clean that off. It can impact the bird. So we don't want to do something like that. I've not really had issues myself with bees other than, I mean, we do occasionally get a bee or two in there, or you find it as you clean out the feeder, but not to the point where they're driving the hummingbirds away from the feeder. I think changing the location is a great idea, and just, you know, frequently changing up the nectar would be another recommendation when it's been super hot. And I think this is just going to be kind of a, I mean, it's just...
There aren't mechanical excluders.
Well, I've heard of hummingbird feeder bee guards. I can't tell you that I know what those look like, but that would be something you could search on the internet. So just bee guards on hummingbird feeders and see what those feeders look like, if there's a little different design feature that keeps those bees at bay and allows the hummingbirds to still feed.
I wonder if maybe putting out a shallow dish of just sugar water someplace else and trying to draw the bees over to a different area would also be something you might want to try.
That's a good idea, too.
Well, that would work. Yeah, I would be willing to try that.
Sure thing.
Okay.
Right. Good luck, Bob.
Yeah, good luck.
All right. Well, thank you.
Yep, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Karen in Madison has a question for you guys. Let's go there. Hi, Karen.
Hello.
What can we do for you today?
I had heard that the DNR, was going to count badgers, and I was wondering if the count was ever done and what they came up with.
David, do you know anything about it?
Karen, that's a good question. So we had a colleague of Jamie and mine, Tim Van Dielen, is a professor in our department, and he had a graduate student a number of years ago doing a study on badgers, and one of the things they were doing was implanting radios just under the skin in the belly, and they were also trying to get a sense about how many were out there. And I'm not sure about the results of that study, in all honesty. And I'm guessing, Karen, if you go to the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources webpage, and they've got a search engine right there, if you just type in survey badgers or something like that, something might come up. I am not, I guess, Jamie, I don't know if you are, but I'm not familiar with the survey results or how many badgers they determined might be in the state of Wisconsin.
So that study was really an ecology study. It looked at, you know, how they move and utilize the landscape, their home ranges, and, you know, where they pick their den locations and things like that, and fairly small sample size, which is often the case when we're doing telemetry studies, and not necessarily statewide. But the other study I'm at least aware of, but again, haven't seen results or that I can recall, was a genetic study out of, I believe it was Milwaukee.
UW-Milwaukee.
Yep. And that student was getting tissue samples from road-killed and incidentally trapped badgers and trying to build a genetic look at the population.
Right.
So that would be another one to kind of look for off the Department of Natural Resources website. And then finally, the other thing you might try to locate on that website is that we do have a rare mammal form that can be completed when people do see something more unusual for the area, whether it's a bobcat or a moose or a badger. And so we know from those reports that we do have badgers in every county of the state they've been reported. Often when David and I are at the Farm Technology Day show working with the agricultural community, the farmers, they're the ones that often will report that they've seen badgers, more so than you know, folks living in urban areas and so on. So it's really those folks that are out work in the fields every single day that often have those encounters. So, again, we have them in every county of the state, but I'm not sure that I could hazard a number.
I don't
right
know
now.
Either. And I know that the DNR pilots, I think when they're flying around, that they also record badgers, and they may actually, you know, part of their time flying, they may actually actively be looking for badgers as well. So, you know, they're a reclusive animal. They're fossorials. They live underground, and they're mostly nocturnal. So they're kind of hard to count in general, and that's been one of the difficulties with actually getting a robust population estimate on badgers here in the state or probably anywhere else in the country.
Yeah, there we go.
What I thought, too, because we had a badger on our farm, and of the seven of us who live there, only one ever saw it.
Yeah.
Saw the den, but they're hard to find.
They are.
We see more and more with the use of trail cameras. So, again, Snapshot Wisconsin has the potential to really give us some valuable data on some of these rare mammal sightings across the state. So that, again, that program is going to be just data rich. So that'll be a good question that program will hopefully be able to ask distribution and maybe an index of abundance.
Yeah. Thanks, Karen.
Thank you.
Bye. Yeah, appreciate the call. Jerry in Sturgeon Bay, it's your turn. Hi, Jerry.
Yeah, good morning. I'm a Purple Martin fan and have had a house for several years. And I had one Martin very briefly come and sit at my house this year, but nobody around that I've seen had any purple martins this year. And I wondered if you had an opinion about what's going on with that.
Jerry, that's a good question. And one of the answers I'm going to give you is species are very variable in the fact that they can move around, and mm-hmm. they will certainly be in one location perhaps 1 year, and then they might move to a different location the second year or a subsequent year because something's changed in the habitat, for example. Maybe there's not as much food in the prior location, or maybe there's better nesting in the second location, or maybe all the good-looking martins move someplace else, you know, and all the males are following them. But there's a Facebook post up here from Karen, and she emailed asking how often she should clean out her birdhouse. Her large purple martin house is getting heavy. So the inference from that is that she's actually got quite a few purple martins this year, and that's just an indication that some people can have them 1 year and other people may not have them at all, similar to what you're doing. The other guess I might hazard out there is I know at least where we live, the mosquitoes have just been thick this year. And partly we've had a lot of rain, and you know it's been a good mosquito year. And there are communities that do spray to try to keep mosquitoes down. And purple martins are an insectivore-eating bird, so an insect-eating bird, and they love mosquitoes of one of many different types of flying insects. And if they're spraying in your area and are actually knocking the mosquito population down, and obviously when they spray for mosquitoes, it doesn't just affect mosquitoes. It might affect other flying insects in terms of knocking those populations down. And if the food source is not there or is not abundant enough, the purple martins may be leaving someplace or going somewhere else where there is an abundant food source. And so that may also be happening in your area. But other than that, I don't have any concrete reason why you're not seeing purple martins this year in your area.
One thing you could do is go to eBird
mm-hmm. yeah.
and yep. take a look. And what's the, Jamie, do you know the offhand how to, if you just put in eBird.
Yeah, Wisconsin eBird, so E-Bird, that'll get you to the website. And then you can type in species-specific information. So you could type in purple martin and look at where sightings have been. And you can drill through that data, too, and look at last year. You could call up a map yep. of last year compared to this year and make some anecdotal comparisons there too. But I've not taken any other phone calls, nor have I heard anything in, you know, just in our circles of colleagues and so on. So,
hurting or anything, yeah.
Certainly they're a species we need to be watching, and providing those man-made houses is their primary nesting source. So,
sure. Good. Jerry, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. And by the way, you can join in, too. If you have a question, we've got open lines. Get you on pretty quickly at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or go ahead and post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Let's go back to Karen's email about her purple martin birdhouse. She's getting heavy. You know, how often should you clean those houses?
Well, so as you talked a little bit about, Larry, you've got a wren in your yard that's nesting, you know, this late in the year and or this late in the summer. And so many of kind of those passerine birds or those small songbirds will have multiple clutches or nest multiple times over the course of the breeding season, you know, maybe two or three times. And so you want to kind of watch as these birds are coming and going, especially if you have a purple martin house or some bird houses. Just kind of monitor that. And you don't necessarily want to stick your nose in there or open the birdhouse and draw attention to it because you're leaving your scent for mammalian predators on the house and things like that. But maybe every day, just from a distance with binoculars or your bare eye, just kind of keep an eye on that. And when you start seeing the fledglings or the young birds start poking their head out and actually leaving the house, then you can take that house down, clean it out, and get it ready for the next clutch of birds. And so I'm guessing now if Karen, if you wanted to go and maybe take a look at your house, or even if the house is, I'm guessing it's up in the air, if you need to bring it down to ground level, maybe take a look at that really quick. Just put an eye in the holes and see if you see young in there anymore. If you don't see anything in there, clean it out, raise it again, and see if you can get another clutch. It's a little late now for perhaps another clutch to start, but you never do know.
Yeah. There we go. Stephen Bloomer up next. Hi, Steve. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I don't personally use trail cameras, and I didn't catch all the conversation about the Snapshot Wisconsin program.
Yeah.
But can people that have trail cameras that they can hook up to with, like, a smartphone and get the pictures basically instantaneously, could that be a possibility for those cameras to be tied in with the DNR if people wanted to, so that they DNR wouldn't have to be buying all the trail cameras?
Yeah.
So, Steve, that's a really great question, and it's one that they frequently get asked, but they are using a standard camera. They're using a Bushnell camera with standard features. So in order to make the data uniform in terms of how it's collected and not to bias the data, they are using a sampling design that involves using the exact same camera spread out. Just in case, well, there are differences, as you probably are aware of, with trail cameras in terms of their sensitivity, the various functions and features they have. So at this point in time, they are really being selective in terms of using the cameras they have. So if it is something you're interested in doing, they'll provide the camera for you. Right now, they're taking enrollment for Sawyer and Iowa counties. And then also educators, any educator in the state that's interested in hosting a camera as part of an educational project on property they have access to or the educational facility owns can also apply for a camera. You can go onto their website and put in your information. Once your county is being rolled out, then they will contact you. So even if you don't live in one of those counties, you can get signed up. And then when it comes into your area, they will have trainings for you on how to set up the cameras in terms of where they would like them positioned. They're trying to avoid getting a lot of humans in the pictures. So yeah. Anyway, you can learn a little bit more about the protocol and what they're doing. But at this point in time, they're not using personal cameras. I would say they do have a opportunity for you to upload interesting pictures on a trail cam page that the Department of Natural Resource maintains. So if you have any really interesting pictures, whether it's an unusual sighting or just a particularly, you know, comical picture of an animal, you can upload those off of personal cameras to the website. So
yep.
Great idea, though. Thanks, Steve.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And Karen in Racine up next. Hi, Karen. Thanks for calling.
I heard a program on NPR just a few weeks ago, which a physician and a scientist wanting to eliminate the entire population of mosquitoes to prevent things like the Zika virus. And I'm just wondering how that's all going to affect the birds who need those to survive.
I doubt that that's ever going
to
happen.
Yeah, I think that if anybody is ever able to eliminate all mosquitoes, they'll probably win the Nobel Prize or something like that, because that would be a task. So it depends on the bird species, but we have some insectivores like purple martins we've been talking about this morning, the swallows, barn swallows, things like that, chimney swifts, common nighthawks. You know, those are species that catch insects on the wing as they're flying. And they certainly do eat mosquitoes, as do all of the bat species as well. And they certainly will eat mosquitoes, but mosquitoes are not the only food source that they'll eat. So let's just hypothetically say they were able to get rid of all the mosquitoes in our area or in the world or whatever geographic location you want to think about. We don't really have any animals that are solely locked in on only mosquitoes as their food source. So they could go, if mosquitoes are not there, they might eat some moths or some flying beetles or something like that. In addition to, even though they are primarily insectivores, they also do occasionally eat some other foods that are not insects and things like that. So they most likely, it shouldn't affect the birds too much as long as there's an abundance of other food sources out there for them.
There we go.
My father is 95, has been Rhinelander, and he's kept a log for the last 35 years on how many birds he sees in the yard. And since a lumber company has forested, clear-cut hundreds of acres near him, and they spray it with Roundup to kill everything, he's noticed a big decrease in birds.
Yeah. In birds.
Yeah, so, you know, that's there's not necessarily anything wrong with clear-cutting, and clear-cutting certainly benefits a lot of other species. So it helps rough grouse, for example. It helps deer and, you know, small mammals and things like that. And no matter what you do, whether you clear-cut or whether you take a field and you plant trees in there, there's going to be some species that win with that habitat management practice, and there's going to be other species that lose. And that's just the way it is. No matter what you do to manage habitat, you cannot benefit every single species out there. And so even though he may be seeing some fewer bird species in his general area, It doesn't necessarily mean that it killed the bird species in that larger regional area. The birds have just moved someplace else where the suitable habitat that is forested is available, and then they can live in. So, and those birds will come back as the habitat recovers and the trees start growing back in that area.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling, Karen. John in Green Bay up next. Hi, John. Thanks for calling.
Hi. A few years ago, while camping near Ely, Minnesota, a strange creature walked into the campsite, and the only way I can describe it is that it looked like a cross between a gray squirrel and a woodchuck. Afterwards, I found out that this was a Franklin's ground squirrel, and I had heard that Wisconsin did have a population of these, but they had since been extirpated, and I'm wondering if there's any records of them having come back.
Hmm. Well, I don't know that the Franklin's ground squirrel is listed as a threatened or endangered state species, but I do know it's a species of special concern here in Wisconsin. And as Jamie mentioned earlier, there is a rare mammal reporting form, and certainly a Franklin ground squirrel here in Wisconsin would be considered a rare mammal because it's not seen very often. And I know at least a number of years ago, the DNR was making a concerted effort to get more population information about those species in terms of perhaps how many are there, what's their current range and location and things like that. And I think there's still a lot of information and data that needs to be collected, and the jury's still out, so to speak, on what that population status is for the Franklin's ground squirrel here in Wisconsin. But I will say your description, I think, was pretty spot on. And I've not seen one out in the wild in person. I've seen pictures of them, and they always seem kind of like a hunchbacked, small gray mammal, similar to what you've described. And I think that was a pretty good description. And if you saw it up in Ely, I think you should consider yourself lucky because not many people see these animals much anymore.
Yeah, and Wisconsin's on the edge of their eastern range, so they're more of a prairie species. I did see them very frequently when I was doing some waterfowl research in the Dakotas, looking at duck nest survival, and they were a very common predator of duck nests. So we saw them quite often. So very similar, you know, in habits to 13-line ground squirrel would be our more predominant species here. So, but yeah, we are on the edge of their eastern range. So
there you go, John. Thank you very much for calling. Talking today with Jamie Nack and David Drake from UW Extension and the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at the University of Wisconsin. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for joining us today to take a look at the world of wildlife with our two guests, Jamie Nack and David Drake. I'm Larry Mueller. Questions for us, 1-800-642-1234, the number. If you want to post a photo, go to our Facebook page. Our Facebook page titled The Larry Mueller Show, and we've got some nice ones already. We have a visitor post about from someone about, see who it's from Paul, about 160 pairs of nesting purple martins plus subadults live on Rock River Road east of Fort Atkinson. Houses are erected by a guy to honor his father, by Gary Woolman, to honor his father, Reverend Orville Wolfram, Koshkonong Township historian and longtime ecologist. So we've got a photo there. And
that's maybe where all the purple martins are in there. They're hoarding them.
Judith sent a video of a mom and her twins, fawns. So we've got that up for you. And here's Zach with a photo of, he's hand feeding a hummingbird, which is really a cool shot.
Yeah.
Well, it's actually a video.
Yeah.
And then
look at that.
Chuck sent a photo of a badger. This guy was, he said, was near his burrow in Vernon County in mid-July. I did a long lens, but he got a really nice photo.
That's a very nice picture. Yep.
So if you have a photo you want to post and a comment along with it, or even a question, put it on our Facebook page, the Facebook page title, The Larry Mueller Show. Let's turn to Jess in Oregon next. Hi, Jess. Thank you for calling.
Hi there. I have a question about the disappearance of the kestrel hawks in southern Dane County. Where'd they go?
Well, I think the answer is probably similar to what David was asking or had mentioned before as a plausible explanation. We've, again, not heard anything about kestrel populations declining, but, you know, small mammal populations vary from time to time, and also in a local area. They may have just moved from the area where you typically see them for greener pastures, so places where there's more prey abundance for them. But again, probably the easiest place for us to see or look for kestrels is just when we're driving the country roads, looking on those high lines, the telephone poles. If you see a kestrel-sized bird sitting by itself on a high line, it's very likely that that's what it's going to be. And the males have a more blue coloring on their bodies. The females are a little more brownish in color. And typically, you'll only see them in pairs when they're in their breeding season. Otherwise, they're a very solitary hawk. So you'll just see the individuals. And again, they... I see them a lot just on the highways, you notice them. So they're hunting in the medians. They're the bird that once they've located their prey or they suspect there's prey, they hear it, they're able to hover or maintain their location like a helicopter or a hummingbird, and then will eventually descend and pounce on that prey and take it back up, either eat it on the ground or take it back up on the wire and consume it. So we still see them. Haven't heard anything in terms of concern for them. They're another species that's a cavity nester. You can build nest boxes specifically for kestrels and put them up. It's often I see them on telephone poles or a post in an open area where they can look for small mammals.
And again, if you want to check on eBird.
Yep, you could look on eBird.
And go online to eBird and take a look and just see what the sightings are.
Yep, you could zoom in for Dane County and look at the sightings specifically for that county.
Yep. Yep, there you go. Thanks, Jess, for calling. Nancy and Madison up next. Hi, Nancy.
Hi. I was wondering how late, well, I had in one of our recent big thunderstorms, I had a very sodden fox run under my porch, and I noticed then that I checked out the back of the porch, and it seems that I have both a front and rear exit, entrance and exit, and I was wondering, is it likely that I could have a den? And I was wondering, how
porch.
Late in the season could a fox make a den?
Mm-hmm. Nancy, that's a good question. Most likely what I'm guessing is going on, the entrance and exit to that burrow could be a groundhog or what's also called a woodchuck.
Mm-hmm.
And the
I've had a woodchuck before.
Yep, yeah. And so their hole looks somewhat similar to the hole to a fox den, and uh-huh. certainly fox are very common, especially in urban areas, to den under people's porches and garages and things like that. So
you said it is or isn't?
It is very common for in urban areas for fox to do that. And typically, you know, the fox hole is maybe not be quite as large in diameter as the groundhog hole would be, but I'm guessing because this is awfully late in the season. Typically, fox are done denning, and when they're not reproducing, they're not tied to that den at all. So, you know, by let's say April or May at the latest, they've had their litter. The litter's been born, and they're well on their way to raising those young. And usually by the end of June or so, they're not tied to that den any longer.
Okay.
Until the next year when they start denning again.
Okay. So when it ran in, I saw it go under the deck. So it was just trying to get some shelter?
Yeah, most likely.
Okay.
But I will say this. We have got a project here in Madison where we are live trapping red fox and coyote and radio collaring them. And we're always looking for places where fox are at potential to trap. And so if you want to send me an email with your address, I either myself or my graduate student would be happy to come out and take a look. And if it is something that maybe a fox is regularly using, if you'd be amenable to us setting a live trap and trying to catch that animal to radio collar it for part of our study, we'd be very grateful for you to do that.
Okay.
But if you'd like to email me, my email is drake, then the number 2 at WISC, the first four letters of Wisconsin, .edu. So ddrake2@wisc.edu. And if you want to email me with your address, we can come on and take a look, and we can tell you for sure whether that's a groundhog burrow or if there is actually a fox there, and is, the fox is there regularly.
Okay.
All right. Thanks. So it's ddrake2, the number 2.
Yep, the number 2.
At wisc.edu.
Yep, wisc.edu. Yeah. Thank you very much, Nancy. That'd be great.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for calling in. Tom in La Crosse has something for us. Hi, Tom.
Hi. Say, we've had like 4 to 6 breeding pairs of indigo buntings ever since I can remember. And, in fact, the record we have is 8 males on the feeder at one time, quite a sight. But in the last 2 years, I've seen 1 or 2 in the spring and don't see them again. Have no idea why.
Well, so you are seeing them, and then you don't see them. Is that?
I see like 1 or 2 early in the spring, and then they're gone.
Well, so indigo buntings are what we call a neotropical migratory bird, neotropical passerine. So they will leave our area in the winter, come back up here, and establish breeding territory in the spring and the summer. And so it is very possible that the ones you're seeing in the spring are their early migratory returning birds, and they've established territory. Have raised a young or a clutch of young, and then once they've raised that clutch, then they've left your area. So that's possibly what's going on there, especially if you're seeing them early and then not seeing them after that.
Yeah, because I've always seen them early and then all summer, and then they leave, you know, in the fall.
Well, yeah, for them to leave in the fall is normal because they're migrating
right,
south.
Right. I'm just saying, though, that I went from having a lot of breeding pairs at the feeder to having none.
Yes. So when they come up, they'll come up in flocks, and then they'll kind of disperse because there's only so many breeding territories, and the male that's occupying that single breeding territory is very territorial and defending that territory. So what you might be seeing is that when they come up together and you're seeing multiples at your feeder, they may be just coming back into our area upon spring migration, stopping at your feeder to refuel, so to speak. And then they're either continuing on further north in their migration, or they're dispersing onto breeding territory, and that's why you're not seeing more than maybe 1 or 2 at a time after that.
Yeah.
Okay, well, thank you.
Yeah, thanks for calling. Appreciate your call. And Chris sent a nice photo of a couple of fawns playing in the puddles in their driveway. That's kind of cute.
Yeah, that'll keep you entertained for a while, huh?
Oh,
watching them.
Yeah, that's lots of fun. That's on our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show if you want to take a look at that. Melanie in Polk County has something for us. Hi, Melanie.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have actually 2 bird egg questions and then 1 deer question. Is twice robins have laid about 20 feet from our house in our pine tree. 3 beautiful blue eggs are all busy, and then they go away. And then the eggs are eaten, cracked, died. They did it again. They just lay their eggs, and then they go away. Why are they've done it twice. Why are they doing that?
Yeah, that's a good question. There's probably a couple of different potential explanations for that. But during the egg-laying process, or maybe even early in incubation, something is causing them to abandon that nest. So they're either getting harassed by an avian predator or... a mammal of some kind that's causing them to abandon that. Could be insects, not generally with robins, but something's causing them to, you know, be forced off that nest.
Got it. Okay, and there's nothing I can do about that. So second question, what birds lay eggs on the ground? I found about a 3/4 inch white with brown spots when I was weeding an area that had never been weeded before. It's relatively new 4-year-old property. It's all cleared out. 3 to 4 of them on the ground. I thought that was so interesting.
Were they right on the ground, or was there still like a cup nest, like a bowl like the robin made, but on the ground?
Oh, gosh.
Were they just laying on the substrate, or was there some type of a nesting...
Mat or material.
I'm sorry, I don't remember, because when I get weeding, I start to get pretty crazy. So,
well, just from my own experiences with landscaping and working on mulch, I've often had chipping sparrow nests low to the ground in evergreen shrubs that are a very small cup nest, much like the robin, but very, very much smaller. And while they are low to the ground, they're usually still weaved or on a branch of a piece of vegetation. There are a lot of ground nesting birds in the grasslands, so savanna sparrows and bobolinks
song
and meadowlarks.
A good guess, too.
Right. But those grassland birds are not going to be in your landscape. They really need large open areas of grassland habitat. As David said, a song sparrow is another potential. So if it was a fairly small nest, it's most likely one of the sparrow species. Killdeer and other shorebirds are birds that lay eggs right on the ground. But again, that doesn't really fit the habitat or the yard description.
Plus, you'd see the killdeer, you'd see them because they right. feign injury to try to draw you away from the nest.
Yeah.
Sure. Let me ask one more thing. Is there and I called the show before, Larry's show a couple of weeks ago about this, but there's a different spin on it. Is the three-legged doe that was here last year alone, she came a number of times, she survived the winter and she came back with two fawns. She's a very good mother. They're constantly around. We're in the rural egg area, isolated, but yet they're living in the area. It's real clear and sort of wiping out all of my pollinators, but never, and my home is, and my grass, my yard area is one of their many hot spots. But I'm wondering, what is she, is this how she survived? With I saw her the other day when I was out walking, and she stood up on her two hind legs. She was with her fawns. And she stood up on her two hind legs so she didn't know what I was. It was the most amazing sight I've ever seen, way up in the air on their two hind legs.
You know, and that's something we can comment on. We'll take a quick look at the news and weather, find out what else is in store for us, Melanie, and then we'll be back with some comments. Stay with us. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller, taking a look at the world of wildlife today with Jamie Nack and David Drake from UW Extension. And from the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Great to have them along. And again, thanks for listening. We have lines at 1-800-642-1234. You can post a question or comment and a photo on our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. Love to have that as well. And as we broke for news, Melanie had talked about a three-legged doe. She saw it last year. This year it's back. And it's got twin fawns.
Yeah, she shared a great story. And it is amazing. And we probably, if you spend enough time outdoors, we've all seen some injury or adaptation that an animal has lived through, whether it be hit by a car or whatever be the case, predation. And it's just amazing what they're able to survive with. So that's an adult deer. She saw it last year already. So it's an experienced doe. We know it's at least 2 years old and, you know, it's doing just fine. So it's in an area of reasonable habitat quality that it's able to find the forage, get what it needs and avoid predation. So if it's close to homes, perhaps some of those predators that would likely take that deer are not there. So it may have, learned how
found
to be
the right spot.
Found the yep. right spot, yeah, to avoid the predators but find a sufficient amount of food. The fact that she had two fawns indicates to me that she's in good physical condition despite the loss of a leg, because otherwise she'd likely only have one fawn or no fawn. So I too can remember a time when I watched three, four deer cross the road in front of me, and the very last one was broken at the knee, and it was healed, sticking straight back, and it moved just fine. Yes, it was the last one, but it crossed the road and stayed with those others and was getting along just fine on three legs. So interesting story, but it sounds like she's in pretty good health.
Yeah, absolutely. And thanks again, Melanie, for that. Scott in Chippewa Falls, your turn. Hi, Scott.
Hey, I was just listening a week or so ago about your the Japanese beetles and stuff, and I think I may have found a cure for that with our blue jays out there.
Oh, your blue yeah. jays love them, huh?
Oh, definitely. The other night there was about, I got a linden tree about 20 feet tall out in the backyard, and I was watching them out the window, and there's like four on the ground, and one would fly up next to the trunk and hop out onto the branches. And the other ones on the ground, you could see the Japanese beetles fall off, and then the blue jays on the ground would just attack it, and then the one in the tree would come down and have to wrestle them away from the other one.
That's pretty neat.
And yep. this went on for about, I would say, a half hour.
That's really cool.
That's pretty neat.
Yeah.
I didn't know they ate those.
Yeah, well,
they have a pretty generalist diet. They'll eat just about anything that resembles food, whether it's some scraps from us or acorns or berries or fruits, insects. They'll eat just about anything.
So. Lots of protein there.
Yeah, lots of protein.
Sure.
Well, that's great. Hopefully, I got some bigger blue jays up here in Chippewa.
Yeah, hopefully they'll just if they could just focus on those beetles, right?
Thanks, Scott. John called to say that, just a reminder that kestrels are actually falcons and not hawks.
And that was my, I misspoke on that. So they are the smallest falcon that we have here in the state. So yes, a falcon, not a hawk.
Molly in Mequon, thank you for calling.
Yes, thanks for taking my call. I'm concerned about birdhouses. Every year the wasps either take them over, or else I'd heard that there was some kind of lice that occurs and that we could clean it. We should clean it out with diatomaceous earth, which I did once, but I wasn't sure if that affected the birds. And what do I do about the wasps?
Yeah, that's a good question, Molly. Depending on the type of birdhouse, but most birdhouses, you should be able to open up either the front wall or a side wall or something like that. And if you're able to just open that birdhouse very quickly without getting stung, maybe just open it, prop it open, and then leave the area for a little bit and just let those wasps kind of clean out of there. And then you may have to just go back either with a long-handled broom if they're still around there, or a whisk broom or something like that. But carefully and obviously not to get stung, but carefully try to just sweep all of the nesting material out of there and try to get those wasps out of there as well. Another thing you might want to try to do, if you've got one of these gas-powered or electrical-type blowers, a leaf blower, maybe just take that, start it up, and just blow some very fast air in there as well. You could obviously just abandon that house altogether, wait until the winter, and the cold weather will take care of the problem, and then you can try again next year. But diatomaceous earth is a possibility. A lot of times just cleaning, especially if you don't have wasps there, just cleaning that out with your hands or using some gloves on your hands. If you just use your hands, make sure you wash them with soap and water after you get done. A whisk broom, something like that would be beneficial. And then just close that house back up and let the birds go to work on the next nest. And then in the wintertime, a lot of times it's recommended if you would prop that house open or prop the door open so that deer mice won't nest in there and other things like that. And then that kind of, over the course of the winter time, it will kill any ectoparasites like mites or lice or whatever the case might be in there.
There you go. Thanks a lot for calling, Molly. Amy in River Falls, thank you for calling. Hello.
Hello, how are you today?
Great, appreciate the call.
I am calling from Pierce County. I have spotted several dead crows and a gray heron, and I'm wondering if the West Nile virus is around in this area, they're dead in parks. They're in really weird spots. It's not like they're hit on the road or anything.
Yeah.
So, Amy, that was, I saw the topic come through on our screen here, too, and that was the first thing that I was thinking about, too, is some concern for West Nile. And I think you could go and look on the state's website to see if it's been documented in your county. If it is, they might not be collecting any more specimens. The other thing with the collection is it needs to be freshly dead. So if it's already starting to decay, those are not able to be tested. However, all that being said, I think it would be wise to call your local wildlife biologist and talk with them about where you were seeing the dead birds. So whether it's just in one location or a couple of locations, they'll be interested to know how many as well. Is it just a dead crow or is it multiple individuals? So I would just recommend talking to your local biologist in this case. They're the ones that are going to be tuned into your local area and what's going on.
Mm-hmm. Okay, would that be the DNR then?
Or yeah.
The Department of Natural Resources. Again, you can go to their website. You can look under the directory, and you can put in your county and look for the wildlife biologist for your county. You could also call their 1-800 customer service number and ask for that information directly.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks for the call, Amy.
Jan in Rhinelander, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi, I just I came in kind of late to the show, and I heard the comments about the bees and hummingbirds, and then the last lady had also trouble with wasps. And I wondered if you had any success with the it's like a bag, a cloth bag that looks like a nest, and then you hang it up like on your deck or wherever you don't want the bees to come, and they see that nest that looks like a, you know, it's a nest, and then they don't come near that because they figure somebody else's or some other bee or wasp has already taken over that territory. Are you familiar with that, or?
Yeah. I'm not familiar with them. I think in the house that we have now with all the overhangs, we would have to have a lot of those cloth, you know, nests to cover up all the potential areas they could take up. But I'm not, but I'm guessing perhaps we'll have an entomologist guest in the future here. So,
sure.
Phil's going to be on, let's see, August...
coming up.
Third Wednesday of the month.
Okay. Ah,
so 2 weeks from today.
Yeah, 2 weeks from today. So
August 17th.
Yep, he would definitely be able to field that question better than us.
So hang on to that thought, Jan, and thanks for calling. I want to go to some comments that we've gotten, one and relating to butterflies. A caller in Gillett asked how monarch butterflies population is doing. Linda emailed to say she's noticed a huge lack in butterflies. She used to see sulfurs and white butterflies by the thousands 20 years ago. Now they seem scarce. Wondering, you know, what could possibly be, you know, she said, what about insecticides or climate change? Is that going to have any kind of effect as well?
Yeah, all those are good suppositions. You know, when people make mention that they don't see as many of something as they did in last year, years past, you know, there's a couple of possibilities for that. Number one is, again, as we've talked about, the populations just may have moved to a different location. Maybe we're not as observant, or for some reason we're not as observing things the same way we have in years past. Things like that. Habitat may have changed. You know, there are some climate change issues going on that we don't fully understand all the ramifications or consequences of that. There's no doubt. In terms of the monarch butterfly populations, though, there really is a true decline in those. And it's thought that maybe the monarchs are maybe 10% of what they used to be in years past. And as a matter of fact, it's gotten so alarming that there was a presidential directive to some of the federal agencies. And a good source of money has been put toward understanding how to bring monarch butterfly populations back. And obviously monarchs are tied to milkweed. And so one of the thoughts is we just need to plant more milkweed, but there's some differing research out there as to whether or not that actually is substantial and is a good consequence. If you plant more milkweed, do you actually get more butterflies? The assumption is yes, but nobody knows that for sure. So there's a lot of information, a lot of research right now being directed on monarch butterflies across their entire flyway. And obviously monarchs are a migratory species as well. So at least with monarchs, I do know for a fact that those populations have reduced and are reduced drastically, and people are starting to look at that right now.
If I can just put in a quick plug for an upcoming program, the Horicon Marsh Education and Visitor Center is always doing, they are always doing interesting educational workshops and opportunities for the public to get involved. But on August 30th, they're going to be doing some monarch tagging from 1 to 3 p.m. So they're going to catch monarchs, and then you'll be able to watch the DNR staff tag them before they start their migration to Mexico, is where many of them end up. So there's a great opportunity to get some answers to those monarch-related questions and participate in that tagging option.
Like that. I like that a lot. You can join in, too. We've got open lines. Get you on real quick at 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page a photo and question there. We'd love to see those as well. But we'll get you on pretty quickly if you phone in right now. On butterflies, I mean, it's a good time of the year typically for seeing butterflies, and we do have some endangered species. I know the Karner blue is one, and that's a pretty rare butterfly, isn't it, David?
Yeah, this is a pretty interesting story. So Karner blue butterfly is about an inch or so long, you know, across its back, so a very small butterfly. And it used to have a pretty extensive range in the eastern part of the United States. Now, mostly the range is contracted down to the Midwest, and primarily due to habitat loss, among other things, but it's primarily due to habitat loss. But in the Nisida Wildlife Area up in the central part of the state, has got the largest population of Connor blue butterflies of anywhere in the country right now. And so that is a federally endangered species of butterfly. The other thing that's going on up in the CETA is they've got a small population of buffalo. And one of the things that some of the researchers have been looking at is that buffalo seem to benefit Connor blue butterflies quite well in a number of ways. So the interesting thing about Connor blue butterflies is that they are tightly tied to a prairie plant called a wild lupine. And the Connor blue butterflies, the caterpillars feed on that. The females lay eggs on that. And so they really need the lupine quite a bit. But lupine is a prairie plant that the seed is very hard and needs to be scarified with fire or needs to somehow be broken open. And one of the things the buffalo do is they roll around on the ground, and as they trample across the ground their hooves, is that they break open these lupine seeds and allow them to be scarified so they can germinate in the soil. The other thing buffalo seem to do a lot of times is as they're a very heavy animal, they've got very sharp hooves, that those hooves kind of cultivate or almost break up that hard prairie soil so that a lot of these prairie plants can actually germinate and take hold in the soil. And the last thing that buffalo seem to do is as the buffaloes are eating, they obviously go to the bathroom. You've got all these buffalo pies laying around. And one of the things in prairies a lot of times is there's not a lot of mineralization or minerals available. And butterflies need minerals to kind of sustain themselves in their life cycle. And so one of the things these researchers have found is that Connor blue males are tightly tied to the buffalo droppings because there's a lot of mineral in the buffalo droppings that the Connor blue butterfly males are feeding off of. So there's a pretty interesting symbiotic relationship between Connor blue butterflies and buffalo here, at least in Wisconsin. And we can see that. Yep, you go up to Sandhill Wildlife Area and you see it up there, and you can see that for yourself.
It'd be a lot of fun to, I haven't been up there to see that, but I really would like to go and have a look. It sounds like a lot of fun.
Yeah, it's a pretty interesting story.
Carol in Wausau has something for us. Hi, Carol. Thanks for calling.
Hi. My daughter works at the Monarch Lab at the University of Minnesota Twin Cities. And if you go, there has been some decline, of course, of the monarchs, but there are a number of organizations that are sponsoring. People can become citizen scientists, so they can register and they can help track monarchs. One of them is Monarch Watch, and I believe it's .org.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
You can also go to, and I know I realize it's not in Wisconsin. I'm sure there are others at universities in Wisconsin, maybe Stevens Point. But if you go to the University of Minnesota Twin Cities Monarch Lab, if you Google that, I'm sure that they have other links also to other organizations.
Oh, that's great points, Carol. Thanks so much. And good organization there.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, monarchs are one of those things that I think just about everybody can recognize a monarch. Yeah. And we seem to all have a soft spot in our heart for those butterflies. So we'd like to see them recovered, no doubt.
Yeah. Thanks again.
One, can I just add to? I meant,
sure.
In September in the Twin Cities in St. Paul, I believe it is, there is also a Monarch Festival. I think it's September 10th, and they could probably just Google Monarch Festival, but it's fun. They have music. They also tag the butterflies there. So anyone that may be in that area at that time or traveling there may want to check it out. It's a lot of fun.
Oh, thanks, Carol.
Yeah, thanks for all the great tips on that.
I appreciate the call very much. Well, Meredith in Dells has something for us, too. Meredith, hi.
Hi. I had a question. I was out in my front yard about 2 days ago, and I walked by a tree, and on my way back, something was chattering at me, and I looked up, and there was a bird. It was about 2 feet tall, and it had white on its chest and white and black on its head. And it kept chattering at me, and then when it took off, it flew right over my head and looked at me like it was curious about me, too. And I wondered if an immature eagle would have black on its head.
No.
No.
Was it a woodpecker species?
No, this is like 2 feet tall. It was a huge bird, huge, like a hawk or be like the size of an immature eagle is what I would think, but it wouldn't have black on its head.
Did you get could you describe, did you see the legs when it flew? Were they hanging? Were they long? Did you?
I didn't see that. I was so curious that he was looking at me. I was looking at him, but he had, like, white on his face, and it almost looked like black sideburns on his, you know, like if he had sideburns. It was black on his face.
Do you think it was most likely, like, a bird of prey? So
a bird of prey, for sure.
Okay.
Oh, yeah, interesting.
Yeah, it was chattering at me, or I wouldn't even have known it was there, you know, and it sounded kind of like the noise eagles make when they kind of chatter, you know, when they're flying.
So yeah. if you're fairly certain it was a bird of prey, you know, an owl or a hawk are going to be the ones of that size. One thing you could do is go to the Cornell Lab of Ornithology to their All About Birds pages.
All right.
And you can look at some of the common birds we would have here. So maybe a red-tailed hawk, they usually, you know, can have a whiter underbelly if you only saw it from the under, you know, from underneath.
So solid white, and then the wings were black.
Yeah, yeah. But you probably only saw the underside.
Right.
Okay.
Because when the flew past me, I just see mainly black on the back.
Okay. Well, what you can do, though, is look through some of the birds of prey, and they'll have audio recordings, so you could try to determine that call.
Okay. The closest thing I seen, I don't remember what it was in my bird book. It said some type of falcon, but I don't remember.
I was just wondering, was it a peregrine falcon, do you think?
I'm wondering if it could have been.
Did it have so we were talking about falcons earlier with the kestrels, and all, you know, falcons have these black sideburns.
Like a mustache,
Yeah, down the side of their head. And I'm wondering if you didn't see a peregrine falcon.
I wonder. But I listened to the program last week or something. They said they didn't land in trees, but it was in a tree, so I don't know.
Yeah, they typically, I mean, peregrines typically are
more buildings
and cliff faces and things like that. But if you're in the Dells, you know, there's rocky cliffs out there.
Right.
And I mean, it's not, they don't typically land in trees, but animals do things that are exceptions sometimes.
Not unheard of.
Not unheard of. Yeah, so look at peregrine falcons and see if that maybe
is
what you saw.
And then hear the sounds, too. You can hear the sounds at the Cornell Ornithology Lab.
Yeah, that's me. Yeah, well, thank you guys so much.
Yep, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Lynn wonders why we have so many rabbits this year, and we do have a lot of them, and I think it's just a question of, you know, some years they're up and some years they're down.
A lot of breeding.
David says it may be a black-crowned night heron.
I don't know.
Yeah, that's a possibility. Possibly. I would think you would probably see the legs in that case as it flew. I know they're a lot smaller than the great horned.
Yeah.
And it, definitely a different bill shape if she can remember what that
Yeah, the black-crowned night heron would have a long yellowish bill.
Yeah, definitely some more possibilities there, though.
Yeah. And, boy, we're about out of time. And you had an event that you mentioned earlier, Jamie. You want to repeat that?
Oh, yes. At, Horicon National or Horicon Marsh at the Education and Visitor Center, they have an upcoming Outdoor Skills Day this weekend, August 6th, from 9:30 in the morning till 12:30 in the afternoon. But they have multiple events all year round to get the public out there and join the marsh. But the one that I had mentioned was the monarch butterfly tagging.
Yeah.
And that is going to be on August 30th from 1 to 3. They'll be catching monarchs, and the DNR staff will be tagging them before they start their journey to Mexico.
There we go. Well, it's always fun to have you guys with us. Thanks so much for being with us again. We'll look forward to your next visit.
Sounds good.
Thanks,
Thank
Larry.
You, Larry.
Jamie Nack and David Drake from the University of Wisconsin Extension and the UW Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology. They'll be back, and we'll talk with them again. Tomorrow, our consumer protection experts will be here with back-to-school tips and information about ID theft, scams, and a whole lot more. Thanks for being around. Stay with us. Lots more in store here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.